The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. And we are reading from the March 13th, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a concerned-looking Uncle Sam. He is vigorously washing his hands at a bathroom sink. He's got a thermometer in his mouth. And on the wall behind him is a map of the United States. It's the United States is in blue, and then there are these red dots that we've gotten used to seeing about where the coronavirus has been detected. The title is Viral Anxiety. How bad will the coronavirus be? Coronavirus outbreak be? And we'll get several stories with that, but we'll start with the main story that was the big political story of last week. Biden's historic comeback transforms race. What happened? In a stunning turnaround, Joe Biden catapulted to the front of the Democratic presidential race this week with a powerhouse Super Tuesday showing that effectively narrowed the primary to a two-person race between the moderate former vice president and Democratic socialist Senator Bernie Sanders. It was an extraordinary comeback for a candidate who'd stumbled in early debates and performed poorly in the first three primaries and caucuses. Biden's campaign was revived after African-American and suburban voters gave him an unexpectedly decisive win in Saturday's South Carolina primary. Senator Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg both then dropped out and endorsed Biden, and their backing made Biden the clear choice for moderate Democrats, panicking at the thought of putting the far-left Sanders up against President Trump. On Super Tuesday, Biden won 10 states out of 14, with surprise wins in Maine, Massachusetts, and Minnesota. The next day, Mike Bloomberg dropped out and also threw his weight, and potentially his war chest, behind Biden. For those who have been knocked down, counted out, left behind, this is your campaign, said Biden at a rally in Los Angeles. Sanders had his share of wins, most notably in Delegate Goldmine, California, where he held a comfortable lead as the week went to press. Faring well with young and Latino voters, he won decisively in Colorado, Utah, and his home state of Vermont. But polls showed that late deciding voters broke heavily toward Biden, who led in the delegate count with 566 to Sanders' 501 as of Wednesday. Senator Elizabeth Warren was far behind with 61 delegates after suffering a humiliating third-place showing in her home state. Sanders said he'd called Warren and that she was assessing her campaign. The rout was a fatal blow for Bloomberg, whose late-entry strategy was built on a $500 million Super Tuesday spending blitz. Sanders, meanwhile, pledged he was in for the long haul. I tell you with absolute confidence, we're going to win the Democratic nomination, he said. You cannot beat Trump with the same old kind of politics. What the editorial said. Hold the revolution, said Wall Street Journal. Just as Bernie Sanders' leftist takeover of the Democratic Party was looking like a done deal, literally in 4 days the Democratic race has turned upside down. Biden's gaffes and stumbles may have worried voters, but the prospect of an avowed socialist atop the ticket has scared millions of Democrats into Biden's arms. To prove he's the Democrats' best bet against Trump, Biden will have to sharpen his game. He'll be back in the relentless media spotlight, and his vigor and acuity will be tested anew. Voters have hit the reset button, said the San Francisco Chronicle. It turns out the results of Iowa and New Hampshire had no bearing on what the larger electorate actually wanted. The Democrats may be divided, but even a fractured electorate can find a single purpose, said the Houston Chronicle. In this case, to defeat Donald Trump in November. What the columnist said: Biden is staging one of the greatest comebacks in American political history, said Jim Garrity in NationalReview.com. And not a moment too soon for the Democratic establishment, who were looking down the barrel of a catastrophe, with House Democrats in swing states openly fretting that Sanders could cost them their majority. 11 governorships are up for grabs this year, some in states such as North Carolina and Montana, where socialism is not an easy sell. But now Biden has delivered the worst beating of a socialist since Rocky fought Ivan Drago. Super Tuesday's clearest message was the limits of Sanders' appeal, said Ronald Brownstein in TheAtlantic.com. Despite the passion of his core followers, Sanders has not generated his promised large turnout of young and first-time voters. And when it comes to building a real coalition, he's failed on almost every front, especially among older and African-American voters. Therein lies Sanders' dilemma, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. As the front runner, he needed to find a way to unite the Democratic Party around him. But that's hard to do when you're running as a revolutionary with obvious contempt for the corrupt mainstream of the party. He's learning that if you treat voters and officials in the party you want to lead as the enemy, a lot of people in that party aren't going to trust you to lead them. Sanders is a risky nominee, but so is Biden, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. His comeback does not change the fundamental fact that he is simply terrible at running for president. On the campaign trail, he's showing his age, meandering in his speech, giving feeble debate performances, and saying cringeworthy things on a daily basis. Once Trump's disinformation machine turns its full power on old Joe, he could suffer the same fate as Hillary Clinton did in 2016. And we'll take in the second main story, U.S. coronavirus cases mounting. What happened? The U.S. braced for a surge in the number of new coronavirus infections this week, with reported cases now spanning at least 16 states, including an outbreak at a Washington State nursing home and cases in New York City and Los Angeles. In all, health officials reported 153 American cases and 11 deaths. 8 linked to the Seattle area nursing home. Los Angeles declared a state of emergency and warned of potential school closures. The World Health Organization said the respiratory illness, or COVID-19, had infected 92,000 plus people and killed 3,200 in more than 70 countries. The mortality rate, 3.4%, in reported cases was higher than in early estimates, though experts say less serious cases may not have been caught by testing. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said the virus was spreading rapidly in the U.S. and was reaching pandemic proportions throughout the world. President Trump named Vice President Mike Pence as head of his administration's coronavirus task force, after infighting and missteps under Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar. Government labs limited access to tests after an initial batch of kits was found to be faulty, and patients with possible symptoms were sent away by hospitals and urgent care clinics. Testing criteria were loosened this week, but only a fraction of the promised kits have been made available. Congress this week allocated $8.3 billion to fight the disease, $6 billion more than the White House requested. The president himself contended the threat was under control. The risk to the American people remains very low, he said. We've done a great job keeping it down to a minimum. What the editorial said: Now the chickens are coming home to roost, said the Boston Globe. For more than 3 years, our science-denying president has gutted the national infrastructure for dealing with a pandemic. Trump disbanded the National Security Council pandemic team and took a scythe to the budget of the Centers for Disease Control, forcing a retreat from pandemic prevention efforts in China. Instead of a scientist, he installed Pence as head of the government's response, even though as Indiana's governor, Pence worsened an HIV outbreak by delaying a needle exchange for months on moral grounds. The president has put lives at risk. Yes, the U.S. got off to a bad start with the crisis at nationalreview.com, but to hear hysterical, opportunistic Democrats describe it, Trump personally concocted the virus in the West Wing. The truth is that, by and large, the administration has acted appropriately, with travel restrictions to and from the hardest-hit countries and a sensible, if belated, loosening of testing procedures and criteria. What the columnist said: the Trump administration has bungled its coronavirus response in so many ways, said Will Peischel and Jessica Washington and MotherJones.com. The State Department put 14 infected Americans on board two flights from Japan with 300 uninfected passengers. A whistleblower said HHS workers welcomed Americans from Wuhan, China, the disease's epicenter, without proper training or gear. And Pence has blocked government scientists and experts from giving information to the public, effectively taking control of all public government statements on the coronavirus. President Trump's handling of this crisis could cost him the election, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. He's running on a strong economy, booming stock market, and historically low unemployment. But now all of that is endangered by the virus spread. Trump's response thus far is not encouraging. His insistence that the risk of an epidemic in the U.S. remains very low is childish. I wonder if the president understands what jeopardy he's in. America's health care system may not be up to this challenge, said Ann Applebaum in TheAtlantic.com. The hospital system has been pared down to the bone. There is no extra capacity, and everyone knows it. There are 27.5 million uninsured citizens and tens of millions who are underinsured. Already there are reports of costly surprise medical bills for those who sought testing or were forced to quarantine at a hospital. If people must pay to get tested, they may refuse. Epidemics, like disasters, have a way of revealing underlying truths about the societies they impact. Our controversy of the week actually continues in the same vein as the last story. COVID-19. Is Trump up to the challenge? President Trump survived impeachment and the Mueller investigation and has waved away dozens of lesser scandals as though they were nothing more than gnats, said Quinta Jurecic and William Benjamin Witz in TheAtlantic.com. In the rapidly spreading coronavirus, though, he faces a challenge unlike any he has confronted before, one that he can't fix with his usual toolkit of bullying, lies, and claims of witch hunt. As the deadly virus started to spread within our borders, Trump repeatedly made it clear he views the epidemic in purely political and selfish terms, as a threat to the stock market and his reelection. Virtually every day, the president and his aides have used public statements to praise the incredible job they are doing, to minimize the threat, and to blame Democrats for politicizing the epidemic. But denial isn't going to work against a virus that doesn't watch Fox News. Trump owes his success to a visceral understanding that what passes for reality in American society is far more malleable than anyone realized, said Eric Levitz in NYMag.com. But loyal Senate Republicans can't hold a vote to make an epidemic go away. And Trump's angry blame shifting is not going to help him or the nation when Americans start dying. It's Trump's critics who are lying, said Miranda Devine in NYPost.com. Desperate to wring political gain out of what New York Times columnist Gail Collins dubbed Trump virus, the media spent the last week spreading the lie that Trump dismissed the epidemic itself as a hoax. In fact, he used that term to describe the Democrats' claim he'd mismanaged the response. Trump actually deserves credit for imposing travel restrictions on coronavirus-stricken China back in January, a decision Democrats derided at the time as xenophobic. A viral pandemic begins on the other side of the world, and yet the liberal intelligentsia tries to name it after the American president, said Scott Jennings in the Louisville Courier-Journal. Sadly, as this virus spreads, the disgustingly disloyal opposition will be rooting for Trump to fail. Trump can rise to this occasion, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com, but so far he's taken exactly the wrong approach. Rather than poo-pooing worries about the virus and saying everything is under control, Trump should be tapping into that side of himself that overreacts to threats. He should be pulling up the drawbridge and imposing additional travel restrictions, putting true medical experts instead of Vice President Mike Pence in charge of the U.S. response, and spending however much money it takes to control and ultimately defeat this viral threat. Let's hope Trump follows that advice, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. But we're talking about a remarkably ignorant president who can't even grasp the basic medical facts about the coronavirus. Meeting with pharmaceutical executives this week about the effort to develop a vaccine, Trump asked one CEO why he couldn't just use the regular flu vaccine. It's a different virus. And pressed the execs to skip clinical trials and release vaccines in a couple of months instead of a year, that is, before his election. We're facing a global pandemic behind the leadership of a man who doesn't believe in science, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times, and who dismisses all bad news as fake. Anyone looking to Donald Trump for competent leadership in the weeks and months ahead simply hasn't been paying attention. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for woke epidemiology after the World Health Organization urged against saying that people are transmitting COVID-19, infecting others, or spreading the virus because that wording assigns blame. Instead, we should refer to people acquiring the virus. It was a good week for American Samoa, whose profile was briefly raised when Mike Bloomberg won the South Pacific Island Chain's caucuses with 175 total votes. It was the only jurisdiction Bloomberg won after he spent $500 million on his campaign. And it was a good week for computer literacy after Fox News anchor Brit Hume tweeted out a screenshot of his computer, forgetting to close a browser on which the 76-year-old had evidently been researching a sexy vixen set of vinyl lingerie, retailing for a hard-to-resist $15.37. But it was a bad week for eco-anxiety, with a new BBC survey of 8 to 16-year-olds showing that 73% are worried about the future of the planet, with 19% having had climate change-themed nightmares. It was a bad week for Garth Brooks after the country music legend was deluged with online vitriol for wearing a Detroit Lions NFL jersey with the name Sanders on the back during a concert in Detroit. The jersey honored Lions Hall of Fame running back Barry Sanders, but some of Brooks' disappointed fans assumed he was showing support for Democratic candidate Bernie Sanders. Finally, it was a bad week for Oprah Winfrey, who, while delivering a speech in Los Angeles about wellness and the importance of balance in life, lost her balance and fell over on the stage. "It is what it is," mused the 66-year-old later. "You would prefer not to fall, but now I've fallen. Briefing page article takes on a different issue. The housing crisis. Millions of Americans can no longer dream of buying a home. Rental apartments are also unaffordable. Why? What's gone wrong? From cities to suburbs to rural America, the cost of housing has far outpaced increases in salaries. Home prices are growing at twice the rate of wages, and there are fewer houses on the market than in any year since 1982. The single-family house with a garage and a front lawn remains a bedrock of the American dream, even as it recedes from many people's reach. Young adults are one-third less likely to be homeowners than the previous generation was at the same age, and nearly two-thirds of renters say they can't afford a house. The median single-family house cost about $280,000. With demand driving prices at the lower end of the market to rise twice as fast as those of high-end homes. Once the backbone of U.S. wealth, housing has become a civic, economic, and environmental catastrophe. Is renting any better? It's even worse. Nearly half of renters are cost-burdened, meaning they spend at least 30% of their income on rent. Since 1960, renters' averaging earnings have increased 5% as rents have jumped 61%. 11 million Americans spend more than half of their paycheck on rent. They have little choice. After 2011, more than 4 million units renting for $800 or less per month disappeared nationwide. In trendy cities like Seattle and Austin, older multifamily buildings are being demolished or converted into condominiums and co-ops. A minuscule percentage of new apartments are low rent. Today, a full-time minimum wage worker can afford a two-bedroom rental in precisely zero U.S. counties. On average, it would take clocking 127 hours a week at the federal minimum wage to make paying for one possible. Are expectations too high? After World War II, home ownership went from a luxurious status symbol to a national priority. A nation of homeowners, of people who own a real share of their own land, is unconquerable, President Franklin Roosevelt said in 1942. Zoning changes helped create the suburbs, as did improved cars and new roads, enabling people to live farther from work. Mortgage markets developed, and the rate of home ownership grew from 43% in 1940 to 66% by 2000. The size of houses per residence also doubled in that period. It became conventional wisdom to borrow as much as possible, buy the biggest house attainable, and hold on as the property steadily grew in value. But that's no longer feasible for many people. In 1990, 18 months of the median local salary could buy a house in 72 of America's 100 largest cities. Harvard University found, now that's possible in just 25 of them. What is jacking up costs? Demand above all. Houses are supposed to pass between generations, but baby boomers are living longer and staying put. People are also moving less than ever down to 10% of the population annually. After the recession, private equity firms and hedge funds spent an estimated $36 billion on more than 200,000 homes in ailing markets, and their strategy was to evict current residents and target the ultra-wealthy. In New York City, homeless shelters have been filling at the same time towering new luxury condos rise into the skyline. Since 2011, the average cost of a New York condo rocketed from $1.15 million to $3.77 million. Even more perversely, nearly half of Manhattan's new luxury condos are empty. Why not build more housing? The cost of land and building materials such as timber and steel keeps climbing, and there are major shortages of construction workers. That makes it financially unfeasible to build low-income housing. In San Francisco, where the median one-bedroom rental goes for $3,700 per month, it costs $700,000 to build a single new apartment unit. In a lot of cities, the market can't supply housing for people making less than six figures, said James Madden, a Seattle-based affordable housing developer. Even when developers do seek to build dense rental or condo units with affordable prices, they run into NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y, the not-in-my-backyard attitude of existing residents who insist that new construction and new residents will disrupt their views, parking, schools, and property values. Can NIMBY be defeated? Government initiatives can only achieve so much without current homeowners making concessions. California is plagued by crippling housing costs and widespread homelessness, but recently the legislature narrowly failed to pass a law that would have overridden local zoning rules to allow high-density housing. NIMBY is on vivid display in Lafayette, California, a wealthy town of 25,000 outside of San Francisco. Governor Gavin Newsom has said the state must build 3.5 million homes by 2025 to ease the affordability crisis. Yet Lafayette residents were outraged by a proposal to build 315 new apartment units near a commuter train station. When developers and city manager Steve Falk agreed to a compromise of 44 single-family homes on the site, residents went to court to fight that too. Falk resigned, saying he couldn't oppose such a modest plan amid a massive housing crisis. My conscience, Falk said, won't allow it. Time to read a few of the best columns of the week, starting with two from the U.S. Mayor Pete's trailblazing presidential run. Pete Buttigieg's historic candidacy has forever changed America's political landscape, said Tim Thiemann. The former mayor of South Bend, Indiana, ended his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination this week after becoming the first openly gay person to win a primary state, Iowa, in the U.S. history. With his characteristic eloquence, the 38-year-old Buttigieg candidly addressed his sexuality in a way no other public figure has done. He spoke lovingly about his husband, Chasen, whom he kissed and embraced at campaign events. He invoked his Christian faith to gracefully rebuff attacks from homophobic bigots like Rush Limbaugh. Sadly, it was fellow gays who were most openly critical of Buttigieg, scorning him as too guarded, too nerdy, and too eager to please heterosexuals. Mayor Pete, these detractors said, wasn't gay enough. How shameful and disappointing. If my fellow gay people can't accept Buttigieg for who he is, then they're not truly in favor of diversity. The fight for equality is far from over, but Buttigieg's candidacy has shown young people anxious about coming out that being gay is no longer a barrier to full participation in our society. This is, one hopes, just a political beginning. Open partisan conflict on Supreme Court. One of the unwritten rules of the Supreme Court is that you never accuse your fellow justices of playing politics, said Ellie Honig. Justice Sonia Sotomayor recently broke that rule with a blistering dissent in an immigration case that was the equivalent of a 96-mile-per-hour fastball buzzed under the chins of her conservative colleagues. Sotomayor accused the court's five conservatives of favoring one litigant over all others in agreeing 20 times to Trump administration requests to issue emergency rulings staying lower court decisions. President Trump reacted by calling on Sotomayor and fellow liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg to recuse themselves from any case involving him. That won't happen, but the partisan divide on the court is now out in the open. In coming months, the Roberts Court is expected to rule on such politically explosive issues as the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, known as DACA, program for 800,000 Dreamers, abortion restrictions, gun rights, equal protection for LGBTQ people in the workplace, and whether Congress can obtain Trump's tax returns. Will all these cases be decided by 5-4 rulings that favor one litigant? If so, Sotomayor called it out first. This column comes from Canada. This isn't merry old England. Ontario Premier Doug Ford is gleefully trying to start political fights by being pointlessly annoying, said Heather Malik. Ford's progressive conservatives recently forced through a rule change that requires all state lawmakers to sing God Save the Queen in the legislature on the first Monday of each month. The rule took effect this week, and several Indigenous members refused to sing along. New Democrat Saul Mamakaya said the revival of British National Anthem was an attempt to glorify a hurtful and violent colonial past, an era that sought the destruction of cultures, languages, and communities. Ford, of course, was delighted by the refusal because it gave him and his cronies an excuse to huff. Oh, look, he's insulting our queen. But in fact, most Ontarians agree with Mamakwa that the anthem, indeed the entire royal family, is an anachronism, a reminder of an era long past and long past its best before date. When the queen dies, the song will become God Save the King and refer to the absurd Prince Charles. Are Canadians really expected to sing that we hope Chuck will long reign over us? Who among us could manage that without laughing? Requiring obeisance to the crown is a ridiculous gesture, and Ford has made himself ridiculous by insisting. Our feature article, The Last Word, also takes a look at the coronavirus crisis, but in a more particular vein. Scenes from a pandemic. Reports on the advance of COVID-19 in the U.S., Italy, and South Korea. Quarantine in Omaha. I caught the coronavirus on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, said Carl Goldman in the Washington Post. Now the fever's subsided and I'm waiting out the illness. I have the coronavirus and it hasn't been that bad. I am in my late 60s and the sickest I've ever been was when I had bronchitis several years ago. That laid me out on my back for a few days. This has been much easier. No chills, no body aches. I breathe easily. I don't even have a stuffy nose. My chest feels tight, and I have coughing spells. If I were at home with similar symptoms, I probably would have gone to work as usual. I caught the virus on the Diamond Princess, the cruise ship that was quarantined outside Yokohama, Japan, for 14 days. At the end of a 16-day cruise, I took with my wife, Jerry. When I left the ship a couple of weeks ago, I felt fine. We checked our temperatures throughout our quarantine. Jerry and I got a swab test for the virus. Our temperatures were normal. They'd get the swab results back in 48 hours. Our test results had not arrived before we boarded buses for the airport, where two U.S. government planes waited for us. On the bus, I dozed off. When I woke up, I had a fever. I made my way to the back of the cargo plane, where the Air Force had set up a quarantine area cordoned off with sheets of plastic. They took my temperature. It was over 103 degrees. So I took a seat in the quarantine area and fell back asleep until we touched down in California at Travis Air Force Base. Officials from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention came onto the plane and said that three of us who had been cordoned off would fly to Omaha with our spouses if they wanted to come along. The CDC had a quarantine location at the University of Nebraska's hospital. We arrived on February 17th, greeted by a fleet of ambulances and police cars. Officials put me on a stretcher and wheeled me into a van, which made for a very dramatic scene. I easily could have walked myself, despite my exhaustion. On the hospital campus, they put me in a biocontainment unit. The space was sealed off with two double-paneled windows that looked out onto the hallway and a large, heavy, insulated door. Two cameras watched me at all times. A set of computer monitors was equipped with microphones so that the medical staff and I could communicate with CDC officials at Central Command down the hall. The room had last been used for the Ebola outbreak in 2014. A doctor and nurses reviewed my case with me and took a bunch of lab tests. They wore heavy-duty hazmat suits sealed with duct tape and equipped with motors that helped with air circulation. It looked like something out of the Andromeda strain. When the test came back a few hours later, I wasn't surprised to learn that I had the coronavirus. Later, the Tokyo swab confirmed the result. I had caught the virus even before I left the ship. It didn't scare me too badly. I knew my number was up. The way I saw it, I was going to get stuck in at least 14 more days of quarantine, even if I didn't get the virus. So many fellow passengers had come down with the illness, including one of my friends, that I'd gotten somewhat used to the idea that I might catch it too. My wife, however, tested negative and headed to quarantine at a separate facility a few blocks away. After those days being cooped up on the ship together, I think we both relished the alone time. We still could communicate through our phones. During the first few days, the hospital staff hooked me up to an IV, mostly as a precaution, and used it to administer magnesium and potassium, just to make sure I had plenty of vitamins. Other than that, my treatment has consisted of what's felt like gallons and gallons of Gatorade, and, when my fever rose just above 100 degrees, some ibuprofen. After 10 days, I moved out of biocontainment and into the same facility as Jerry. Now we can video chat from our separate quarantines in neighboring rooms. Yellow zone in Milan. Milan is close to the epicenter of Italy's COVID-19 outbreak, said Greta Privatera in Slate.com. Schools and officials are closed. Residents have been asked to avoid contact with others as much as possible. It's day six of isolation, and I wake up to the sound of my phone buzzing. I stretch out my arm to my nightstand, type in my code, and read the message from a dear friend of mine. My kid's been up since 6 a.m. We did a puzzle, had breakfast, watched three episodes of Peppa Pig, and played Spider-Man. At this point, I'm just hoping to get COVID-19. We're among those in the yellow zone, meaning those who live too close to the red zone near Lodi, where on February 21st, the first Italian breeding ground of COVID-19 was found. A second was found in Veneto, and in a few days, hundreds of people had been infected. So, schools, museums, movie theaters, pools, everything is closed. Everyone who can is working remotely. We are allowed to go outside, but asked to avoid contact with too many people. It's 9 a.m. As I've done for the past 6 days, I turn on the news before drinking my coffee. The number of infected people has increased, but an expert is about to explain why we still shouldn't worry too much. My oldest daughter shouts to me that she wants pancakes for breakfast. She's ecstatic to be home from school, so much so that the other evening as she was falling asleep, she let out a little hooray for the coronavirus. Everyone should understand that forced, prolonged exposure to the people you love can, in some cases, create monsters. My husband and I divide the day in half. I work in the morning while he takes care of our girls, and then he gets his turn in the afternoon. There's basically nothing left to eat because we avoided the supermarkets when they were assaulted by people panicking. They looted all the pasta, along with the frozen and canned foods. I could have ordered on Amazon Prime, but in the meantime, I got an email explaining that deliveries were delayed due to COVID-19, so I was discouraged. At any rate, it means we'll have to go to the store without a mask, as we are part of the group that didn't stock up in advance. The day is spent with Peppa Pig on loop, emails, new rituals of washing our hands, now while singing Happy Birthday, and a break to bake cookies. Between episodes, I try to catch newscasts, which are now as addictive as Netflix. One reason why I like the TV news is that I'm trying to avoid social networks. Yesterday, I risked a confrontation with a Facebook friend who posted an article on why we should close the borders on immigrants, right in the middle of the days when other countries are closing the borders on us. If it's not this kind of thing, it's irritation from how everyone I know has become an expert in virology and public health, or the frustration that comes from those who believe coronavirus is a joke. It's just like the flu. Or, on the other hand, those in the panicked, we're all going to die camp. I have the feeling there are many more people who are simply respecting the rules to limit the infection, but they're not the ones posting. At least once a day, I get a message from a friend that says, "I've got a cough. Should I call the doctor? I got a little scared when I had a headache and the shivers the other night, so I secretly locked myself in the bathroom to take my temperature. My youngest found the thermometer and, as a divine punishment, I spent the next hour taking the temperature of all of her dolls. No coronavirus." Recovery in Yongcheon, South Korea. Kim Sung-hwan was one of the first South Koreans to be diagnosed with a coronavirus infection, said Min Ju Kim in The Washington Post. After 8 days of treatment, he's largely recovered. At first, the 47-year-old restaurant owner thought he was just tired from work. Doctors prescribed some cold medicine, but Kim Sung-hwan's headache worsened. He started to run a fever. It was mid-February before clusters of coronavirus infection were reported around his hometown, Yongcheon, about 180 miles southeast of Seoul. But the region would quickly become the center of the country's outbreak. Kim's condition did not improve, and he went to a bigger hospital in nearby Daegu City on February 18th. At that point, coronavirus cases were starting to appear nearby. Just hours before Kim arrived at the hospital, the first coronavirus case was confirmed in Daegu. Nurses in protective gear whisked Kim away to an isolation ward. Kim's account of infection, fear, and recovery is just one story among tens of thousands as the coronavirus spreads around the world. But it offers a window into the arc of the disease for some patients and the toll it exacts on the body and mind. The first moments in the hospital were a blur of activity. Because he displayed pneumonia-like symptoms, he was quarantined in a negative pressure room that keeps the air from seeping outside. Doctors took swabs from his nose and mouth to test for COVID-19. Kim waited for the results in the isolation ward. "The only thing I could hear was the buzzing noise of the ventilator," Kim said. He was not sure if his headache was a symptom of the virus or from snowballing concerns about the possible infection in his family home and his restaurant. As he saw the news of the virus spreading in his town, Kim's thoughts were with his wife and daughter, who had taken care of him at home. He remembered their worried eyes on him tossing and turning in his bed from severe pain. He couldn't sleep for several nights in a row. "I was so tired, but I could not fall asleep because of the aches and pains felt all over my body," he said. The fever induced by the coronavirus felt achingly hot. Kim's body temperature spiked above 100 degrees. Doctors at the hospital prescribed him antibiotics, other medicine, and intravenous fluids. 4 days into treatment, on February 21st, The doctor said his lungs had returned to normal. His symptoms started to ease. His fever broke. His head stopped aching. But the worries still raged. The television he watched to distract himself from the pain beamed alerts of South Korea's first death from the coronavirus. Would it cripple his body? Had he infected his family and the customers at his restaurant? Immediately after Kim's diagnosis, the provincial government tracked down and published the list of the places he had visited during the 4 days since he started displaying symptoms. Health authorities in South Korea take those measures with every patient to help the public identify the risks. The clinics Kim visited and his seafood restaurant were listed online and shut down for disinfection. His family and customers at his restaurant have been tested for the virus. No relatives have turned up positive. Neither has anyone who visited the restaurant, he says, as far as he knows. Kim's health turned a corner last week. He could walk around inside the ward and started doing light exercises. He tested negative for the virus on February 24th and again the next day. On Wednesday, 8 days after he was diagnosed, he was released from the hospital. He is now on a self-imposed 14-day quarantine, staying in his room and not dining with his wife and daughter. The doctors told me I can go back to my daily life, but the fear of reinfection still lingers in my mind, he said. These were excerpted from articles that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a couple of health and science pieces for you, starting with death and the elephants. Wildlife books and documentaries are full of accounts of elephants mourning their dead, a human behavior that is almost impossible for us to confirm in other species. But a study into how these giant beasts react to loss, has concluded that elephants appear to feel something when a fellow tusker dies, even one they're not related to. Researchers examined elephant reactions to 32 different carcasses across Africa, reports the Washington Post. They witnessed elephants touching corpses with their trunks, trying to lift them with their feet, and performing dominance behaviors typically used to protect sought-after resources such as plentiful fruit trees or shady groves. Scientists also observed a 10-year-old elephant walking away from the body of her mother with liquid streaming from her temporal glands, a sign of stress, fear, or aggression. Over the next 3 weeks, members of the five elephant families interacted with the corpse. We don't know what's going on in their heads, says co-author Shifra Goldenberg from the San Diego Zoo's Global Institute for Conservation Research, but we do know that they're constantly updating social information about each other. The health scare of the week has a provocative title: Western food makes you stupid. Eating a Western diet for as little as a week can harm brain function and encourage you to overeat, a new study suggests. Previous research on animals has shown that junk food can affect the hippocampus, the brain region associated with memory and appetite control. To explore whether the same was true in humans, researchers recruited 110 volunteers, all in their early 20s, with a generally good diet. They told half of the participants to keep eating their normal diet and put the other half on a Western diet high in saturated fat and added sugar, predominantly fast food and Belgian waffles. After 7 days, the subjects on the Western diet scored worse on memory tests and were more likely to want to eat unhealthy foods when full, reports The Guardian. The researchers speculate that the hippocampus weakens memories about food when you're full, so looking at a chocolate bar won't inundate you with recollections of how great candy tastes. But when the hippocampus is damaged, says co-author Richard Stevenson from Macquarie University in Sydney, you get this flood of memories, And so food is more appealing. And we'll turn right on over to the talking points page. Afghanistan, a real peace deal? The truly momentous deal the U.S. and the Taliban signed this week could mean America's longest war is nearing an end, said Kathy Gilsonan in TheAtlantic.com. But the U.S. will come away with nothing close to victory, just the beginning of a new process that will give the Taliban a share of the power in Afghanistan. In the deal, the Taliban agrees not to harbor al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups and to enter talks with the U.S.-backed Afghan government. The U.S. will reduce its forces from more than 12,000 troops to 8,600 in the coming months and aim for a full withdrawal by spring 2021. Signed 18 years after we set out to annihilate the Taliban, after $2 trillion spent and more than 3,500 American and allied lives lost, the deal is a tacit admission that for the U.S., getting out of Afghanistan will mean lowering the bar. This is an exit deal, not a peace deal, said Steve Hayes in the Dispatch.com. Negotiated at the Taliban's insistence without the Afghan government's participation, it's loaded with American concessions to our longtime jihadist foe. We'll lift our sanctions and promise to help lift international sanctions, too. Some 5,000 Taliban prisoners are supposed to be released, a provision Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has understandably balked at. Our withdrawal is supposedly contingent on the Taliban's ongoing compliance, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. But President Trump is plainly itching to leave and is likely to pull the troops regardless of what happens, just so he will have something to brag about with voters. This so-called peace deal may be an illusion, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. After the seven-day reduction in violence ended, the Taliban resumed its offensive with a bombing that killed three people at a soccer match. Clearly, the Taliban is not to be trusted. The echoes of Vietnam are clear, said the New York Times in an editorial. Our 1973 exit from the war left the South Vietnamese government to be overrun. But that parallel does not change the fact that a military victory over the Taliban is not possible. So it's time for us to leave. It's a flawed deal, but with so little to show after all these years, it's hard to see what wiser path America could follow. Here's some shorter notes. Ad spending on the 2020 presidential primary has already surpassed $1 billion, the most money spent in U.S. history this year in an election cycle. Democratic candidates have spent a combined $969 million, with $724 million of that total spent by the campaigns of billionaires Michael Bloomberg and Tom Steyer. Experts predict that candidates of both parties will spend a total of $10 billion on political ads before Election Day. The Justice Department is creating a new arm focused on revoking the citizenship of immigrants who lied or omitted information on their applications. The new denaturalization section will target terrorists, war criminals, sex offenders, and other fraudsters, the department said. Antarctica tourism is booming. More than 56,000 tourists visited the remote region during the 2018-19 season, and above 78,000 are expected for the current season, twice as many as a decade ago. Most come by cruise ship, leaving from ports in Argentina or Chile. Two South Carolina school districts have become the first to install airport-style body scanners to screen arriving students for weapons. Last year, there were at least 45 shootings at schools in the U.S., an average of nearly one a week. On the poll watch, we have 79% of American voters say treatment for COVID-19 should be free for everyone. And 65% say that if there were a vaccine available, they would get it. 56% approve of President Trump's handling of the crisis thus far. 33% say they are scared they might contract COVID-19, while 60% say they are not. 42% have increased their hygiene, including washing hands frequently. And we'll finish out with two quotes. The first from critic Cyril Connolly, who says, "The particular charm of marriage is the duologue, the permanent conversation between two people who talk over everything and everyone till death breaks the record." And another one from cartoonist Mel Lazarus, who says, "The secret of dealing successfully with a child is not to be its parent." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.